Hey, old moles. This is Luisa Martinez offering another report back from my recent trip to Venezuela. I was invited as part of a small delegation from the Democratic Socialists of America, or DSA, to be an election observer in Caracas, Venezuela. Over 300 observers were present from 55 countries around the world to witness Venezuelans exercise their right to vote. Dubbed the mega elections, Venezuelans cast their votes for 23 governors, 335 mayors, 253 lawmakers, 2,471 counselors on November 21st. To begin, I'll give a quick primer on how elections technically work. Venezuelans vote through an integrated system of authorization. You need an ID card and a fingerprint. In fact, the voting machine is activated by your fingerprint, and you vote by selecting the logo of your party, though, of course, you can vote for multiple parties. It just takes a little bit longer. Your vote is then printed, and then you drop it off into your assigned box number, and you sign your ballot. So in Venezuela, you vote electronically, and that electronic vote is then confirmed with a paper receipt, which is then verified by your signature. August 26th is the last day to register with the National Registry to vote, which sounds like a long way away from the November 21st deadline, but you only register once, unlike in the United States, where we register every time that we move. If you want a more detailed explanation, you can go to the Venezuela Analysis article, which I can link on the Old Mole website. Now, unlike the cartoonish U.S. narrative regarding Venezuela as some sort of a cruel dictatorship where up is down, black is white, and upstanding middle-class Venezuelans are randomly beaten by Chavistas, what our delegation witnessed was an orderly, peaceful, and fairly quick process. One observation I'll mention is that there's no mail-in voting and no absentee voting. I attended a press conference by the CNE, which is the National Electoral Council, and they made it very clear that it just doesn't exist in Venezuela. In fact, as far as I can tell, mail-in voting doesn't exist in Latin America. And culturally, voting is a collective process that heavily involves the community. Arguably, this is distinct from the way that voting is considered in the United States, especially in Oregon and Washington, which has eliminated in-person voting. Now, admittedly, I'm not the best person to ask. I gracefully received my citizenship about 2 months before President Trump took office. But paperwork aside, I've been politically active for 12 years and did witness successful attempts at voter suppression bills passed in Florida, including what happened in 2011. Clearly aimed at the black vote, the 2011 voter suppression bill eliminated voting the Sunday before Election Day. Now, 50% of black people vote on this day because of a longstanding program called Souls to the Polls. Folks go to church, and then church officials organize vans to take people to their closest voting location. Again, it is a collective experience. But back to Venezuela. To give a political analysis of the situation, the GPP, the Grand Patriotic Poll, the socialist coalition currently elected to power, and the PSU, which is the coalition's biggest party, swept the elections, winning 19 out of the 23 states for governor, except for one state, Barinas, on the Colombian border, which will see another election January 9th after the opposition candidate was disqualified because of administrative and criminal inquiries against him. An important thing to note is that the opposition is back on the electoral route, respecting the Constitution and acknowledging that Nicolas Maduro is the president of Venezuela. The Venezuelan government left the dialogue table that was happening in Mexico between them and the opposition, and of course, the United States always being in the background because of the Alex Saab extradition. Briefly, Alex Saab was a Venezuelan diplomat on his way to Iran and negotiated much-needed gasoline supplies, food, medicine, and other critical materials overseas as a way of circumventing the lethal U.S. sanctions. Saab's plane was forced to land in Cabo Verde and was imprisoned there for a year and a half by the United States, despite there being no extradition treaty, and the Interpol order being released after his capture. It is obvious the imprisonment of Saab was made without any proper legal basis and is another form of judicial and physical intimidation by the U.S. government. He is now illegally extradited and imprisoned in Miami. The Venezuelan government may return to the table next year. It will be the constitutional right of the opposition to try to run a recall campaign against President Maduro, and whether or not they do so will very much be on the table. Another important thing to note is that the European Union participated and certified the elections, the first time in 8 years. This indicates a break away from the Washington narrative. This is perhaps the reason why the United States invited Juan Guaido, the self-proclaimed interim president of Venezuela, more often referred to as the president of Narnia, to the laughably titled Summit of Democracies last week. Even corporate news outlet, the New York Times, questioned the event with the following news blurb. Biden rallies global democracies as U.S. hits a rough patch. The president kicked off his summit as critics questioned the guest list and whether the United States could be an effective advocate for democracy amid problems at home. This, coupled with the decline of the Lima Group and the increasing treatment of the U.S.-controlled organization of American States as a fringe association by Latin American governments, is prompting many to wonder whether or not we'll be seeing the return of the pink tide. Leftist populist Pedro Castillo won Peru recently, and Chile has a tense election in December where they'll have two choices. José Antonio Kast, an extreme right Pinochetista candidate whose father, it has recently come to light, was a bona fide member of the Nazi Party, or Gabriel Boric, a young 35-year-old progressive who rose to political prominence through the student protest movement. One thing that's obvious and distinct from the last time, and that is the renewed role of violence for left leadership. The right wing of Latin America, propped up by the firm hand of U.S. imperialism, makes it clear that it does not flinch at the prospect of violence, but in fact welcomes it. When I was in Venezuela in June, I heard President Evo Morales speak, which was essentially a retelling of the coup where he narrowly escaped with his life. Lula spent a year and a half in jail as a result of trumped up corruption charges and lawfare used against him, but he's now cleared for a presidential run in 2022. This can also be seen in the recent win of Xiomara Castro Zelaya, wife of Jaime Zelaya, in Honduras. Jaime Zelaya, for those who remember, was couped in 2009 after attempting to implement really moderate reforms, including things like land redistribution. Madam Zelaya recently indicated that she would abandon diplomatic relations with Taiwan in favor of China, and President Ortega in Nicaragua did the same. In fact, total China-Latin American trade increased from almost $18 billion in 2002 to almost $316 billion in pre-pandemic 2019. A fact that clearly weighs heavily on empire. Now, whether or not Cubans, Venezuelans, Nicaraguans, and Latin Americans will ever achieve sovereignty outside of the control of the U.S. government is in the air. But what is clear on the horizon is the emergence of a multipolar world, something that gives hope to this Latin American.